Hello, Enlightened Radio listeners. You are listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. Your co-hosts are Stasia Olkowski and
Fanny Crawford.
First up, we want you to know that Megan Hicks, storyteller, creative mind, and origami swami, is performing at Stories in the Round next Monday, August 28th in Hagerstown. We'll talk more about that. If this is news to you, write down this phone number, 301-730-1638. That's 301-730-1638. And we'll talk more.
Thank you, Stash.
You're welcome.
Our story theme today is sky stories. And Stash, when I was working on my stories for today, I found so many different stories with celestial settings and storylines. And of course, we have the eclipse going on. Today is Monday, August 21st, 2017. So it's eclipse day, total eclipse of the sun. And I hope most of our regular listeners are heading out of doors at some point with eclipse glasses or pinhole boxes or even cell phones, any safety device for viewing the eclipse while protecting your eyes. And children, of course, need adult supervision. Children, if you are listening, you need adult supervision for this viewing activity. But I did make a long list of sky story theme related stories. I found traditional tales or thought of traditional tales like Henny Penny. The sky is falling! The sky is falling! There's a Japanese origami tale, something low and something high. In the African American tradition, the people could fly. There are Korean flying dragon stories, historical tales. You've got Orville and Wilbur Wright and Bessie Coleman, the aviator, and Amelia Earhart. Or the original flyer, the ancient Greek myth of Icarus. They're flying ghost and vampire stories. And actually, I'm working on some of those for October tellings around the region. I'm saving those for Halloween. And of course, there's Santa and his reindeer flying across the sky on Christmas Eve. And Stash, you probably have a good list of sky stories too.
I have a couple from different traditions. The dragon in the Chinese folklore, the dragon that comes and eats the moon and the sun. And the people use beat drums to drive it away. And there's a great Hindu story about an evil demon who is about to drink a potion that will make him immortal. And the sun and the moon see him, and they tell Vishnu. And Vishnu cuts off his head before the potion can get past his throat. So his head is immortal and flies through the sky continually. And every once in a while, he catches up to the sun or the moon, and he eats them. However, because his neck is the end of his existence, they pass right through his throat.
Okay, great story. And,
so that's a great one. And there's a great historical story from the Greeks in the 6th century BC. The Medes and the Lydians were about to engage in a large battle, and they had actually both started when there was an eclipse of the sun, and they stopped and dropped all their weapons because they thought the gods disapproved of that war.
Is that in Thucydides or Herodotus? I remember that story.
I'm not sure where it is.
Okay.
But
that's a good one too.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to, I guess I'll start. It's my turn to start. I'm going to tell a story today, and it's an abbreviated version of Mark Twain's eclipse story, Samuel Clemens, much longer story that includes an eclipse bit. So I'm going to just tell the eclipse part, basically.
Sounds good.
So there was once a man who was a scientist. He'd been very well educated in history, in physics, in mathematics, in astronomy. He had many letters after his name. He was a highly degreed individual. And of course, it had cost him a lot in time and money and other resources to get this education. So he was proud of his book learning. And sometimes his book learning kind of got ahead of him, and he didn't always have enough common sense, but basically was a pretty good guy. Sometimes he struggled with empathy, but at some point he has an altercation with someone and that he doesn't start, but he gets knocked out. He's unconscious, and when he comes to, he's sitting under a huge oak tree in the middle of a shady glen, and because he's lying on the ground and his ear is to the ground, he hears. And he assumes that that's horse hoofbeats. So he sits up carefully. He has a splitting headache, having been knocked out. And he sees coming over the horizon a fully armored knight, which, of course, is not what he's expecting. But he does have enough street smarts to know he better get up the tree. So he takes a couple minutes to climb up the trees. Head's not in great shape still. And up the tree he is when the knight comes into the clearing. The knight, of course, has seen him and announces with great fanfare that this man, who I didn't mention, he's a Yankee. He's from the state of Connecticut, where he earned his degrees and his book learning. And he tells the Yankee that he's captive. This is Sir Kay, the seneschal, the foster brother of King Arthur. Now, the Yankee up the tree doesn't yet know where he is or what time period he is. He's waked up in this different world. So they have an argument back and forth about whether the Yankee's going to come down out of the tree, and he finally decides, his street smarts, the little that he has, take over, and he decides it's the better part of prudence to come down out of the tree if he can make a deal, and he gets the knight to agree, to give his word of honor that he won't harm the Yankee, and the scientist comes down out of the tree, and the Sir Kay marches him off into town. And once they get there, of course, the scientist figures out that he's in a different time and place. He's befriended by Sir Kay's page, who the Yankee calls Clarence for no apparent good reason, but he does call him Clarence. And eventually the page reveals to the Yankee that they are in the year 528. And of course, the Yankee, the scientist, is a bit nonplussed. He's confused, and his head still hurts, and he's not sure how he got here. But he does press the young man as to the exact date, and Clarence tells him that it's June 19th. And from that information, the Yankee remembers, the only thing he can remember happening in June of the 6th century, the early part of the 6th century, is that there is the only total eclipse of the sun in that early part of the century will occur on June 21st. And he doesn't think much more about that because it's not particularly useful information in the first day or so that he's there. But he does know that at 3 minutes after 12 on June 21st, there will be a total eclipse of the sun. Well, once he gets to Camelot, he's exposed to the Round Table, and he begins to understand that the knights spend most of their time trying to best each other in storytelling. They tell the most prodigious lies that they can think of, and the Yankee is a little taken aback by the performances that he hears. But it also feeds into his assumptions that he's the best educated man in the kingdom because he hears these outrageous stories being told. And that being the best educated, he should be able to rule the kingdom. And in his arrogance, he thinks this might take only a day or two before he's in charge.
but he does spend some time talking about these stories that he calls the lies of the stateliest pattern told with a gentle and winning naivete. He says the audience at Camelot welcomes these lies enthusiastically and believes them immediately, regardless of the fact that the listener had just told his own outrageous lie just a few minutes ago. They seem completely gullible and willing to be taken in by these stories. They just love these monstrous tall tales. Wouldn't know a proof from a prune pudding. That's not a direct quote. I made that up, that last statement. Well, the Yankee ends up in prison, partly because Serkei does that with his prisoners. He's interested in getting gain from these poor people, unfortunates that he manages to capture. And, of course, the Yankee is one of these. So he's thrown into prison with everybody else. But eventually he figures out that he can use Clarence to help him rule the world or whatever he's able to get from these people to improve his status. So he gives Clarence a message, and he says, "Tell your king, as the most powerful of wizards, I intend to smother his domain and all others round about with a deadly blackness. I will dim the sun till midnight reigns. At the mid of full day, 2 days hence, it will never shine again. The sun will not come back. The fields and orchards will wither and rot. His peoples, every one, every woman, every child, every man will die of starvation." And Clarence runs off, all a tremble and fearful, anxious, completely believing this story. And the Yankee's quite pleased with himself at this story, because he knows the eclipse is coming. And in his mind, these people use no logic common to the scientist's age. They never compare past to present. Their language in ordinary conversation shows clearly they would not recognize a discrepancy nor tell an inconsistency from an incontestable. So he feels relaxed and ready to claim the day. But Clarence soon comes back to report on what has happened at court. And he says that there is a competing wizard, a sorcerer. Now, in my version of the story, this is a sorcerer storyteller who scoffs and says that the Yankee is all bluster, no brimstone, for he has not named the threatened calamity. He has only said that he will make the sun disappear. He has not said how that will happen, and this sorcerer is sure that that is because this is a lesser man who does not know how to do that. He has not the magic to create this reality. And Clarence reports that the king was perplexed and puzzled, confounded and confused, and begs that the Yankee share his plans in greater detail so that the king may understand. The Yankee tells him that he does, in fact, have the magic. He can make the sun disappear, and to go back to the king and explain with more force and ferocity that the Yankee has every intention of blotting out the sun. Well, just a short while later, soldiers come to the dungeon where the Yankee is being held prisoner and tell the Yankee, the scientist, who is now called the wizard. He is now the wizard of the place because he claims that
power. They tell him that he's to be executed. And as they're leading him out to the dungeon, of course, the wizard, the Yankee, is very discombobulated now because his power lies completely on with the eclipse, which won't happen for 2 days hence. So if they're going to execute him early, then he has no means of getting out of this situation. And he had depended on Clarence to carry out his plan, but it's not working. They drag him out of the dungeon. They step into the courtyard and out of the dark passageway from the dungeon into the bright light of day. And the wizard's knees, which were already turning to jelly just from the short trip from the dungeon, nearly give way beneath him. For the first thing he sees is the stake, the timber upon which he is to be bound and burned. And on all sides of the stake are piled fuel for the fire, scrap wood, and limbs of trees, some as big around as his thighs. He's worried. He has no plan. He had a single plan, and it's not going well. Besides the beside the stacks of tree limbs around the stake, stands a single gray-robed figure, a monk, hooded with his arms bent and locked before him, hidden in the folds of his robe. The courtyard itself has been outfitted, perhaps not for this event, but perhaps permanently, but all he sees is that there are tier upon tier of wooden benches rising to heights of 8 or 10 rows and entirely enclosing that inner courtyard with only narrow spaces for entering and exiting the rows. The benches are filled to capacity. There are people crowded in beside each other, and the space in front of the benches is also filled with more people kneeling and sitting cross-legged on the paving stones. Clearly, this is the event of the season, or at least of the week, and all of these people are there for the spectacle. The king and queen are seated on their thrones in a kind of protected part of the courtyard. And as the soldiers hesitate getting their bearings as they're dragging him out to the stake, Clarence, the page, appears at the wizard's elbow, at the Yankee's elbow. And he seems to appear out of nowhere. He's probably been hiding in a nook somewhere, waiting for the opportunity. And as he presses the Yankee's hand, he whispers in a very fast, excited stream of words that, this is my doing. I convinced the king that your power was growing daily and would not reach its fullness until tomorrow. If they wish to avoid catastrophe, they must save the sun by dispatching you now. And he seems very pleased with himself. The wizard's heart sinks even lower, if that were possible. All about the courtyard is dead silence, not a whisper or a movement in the huge crowd as he makes his way across the courtyard, dragged, half-carried by the soldiers to the stake. The chains are wrapped and fastened around the timber, completely restricting the movement of his feet, his legs, and his torso. And then the wood is piled, branch by branch, stick by stick, twig by twig, around the rigid form of the wizard, almost enclosing him from his feet to his knees to his thighs. And then a man steps forward with a flaming brand and prepares to lean forward to touch the torch to the bottommost twigs and branches. At that point, the solitary monk lifts his eyes to the sky and then raises his arms and begins to chant in Latin a prayer. The crowd is watching the monk. All eyes are riveted to this hooded figure. But the chanting slows and then stops entirely. And the monk, his eyes still raised, has something of a stricken expression on his face, and his mouth, no longer moving, is formed into a perfect O. His forehead gathers into furrows of doubt and anxiety. And at that moment, everyone else in the courtyard,
the multitudes, the queen and the king, who had had their eyes riveted upon the monk, now raise their eyes to the sky, and every face mirrors the face of the monk. That furrowed brow of agonized doubt and worry, the mouths forming instantly into little circles of shocked speechlessness, all except the wizard. His face breaks into a delighted grin for just a second, so fleeting that no one else sees his delight, and immediately he composes his features. For he can see, as well as every other person in the courtyard can see, that the moon has just taken a bite out of the sun and is moving, oh, so slowly, but inexorably, casting a shadow across the face of the sun. Now, the gaze of the crowd upon the sun only lasts a second or two, and then every eye is cast down to look at the wizard. In the meantime, he's raised his arms high above his head and leaned forward, stretching toward the sun, pointing at the sun, and a single voice calls out from the courtyard, "Light the blaze!" And then a second voice, fast upon that command, "No! Stay your hand! I forbid any harm to this man." Well, the competing sorcerer, the storytelling sorcerer, leaps from his seat, running towards the Yankee, no doubt to light the pyre himself. The wizard speaks, and he lowers his voice to boom with the authority of heaven, dramatically raising both volume and reverb by bits. He says, "Do not approach. I will blast ye with thunder, smite ye with lightning, and reduce ye to a fine powder upon these stones." Well, everyone freezes, though the storytelling sorcerer is slow to take his seat again. But the king speaks. "Consider, sir, the lives you put at risk here. There was a report that we might avert catastrophe by..." And here the king seemed at a loss for words. The Yankee says, "You believed a preemptive strike would save you. You were grievously misinformed." A low moan is heard escaping from the thousands listening. Hands are raised in supplication, trembling towards the king. The king begins again. "Sir, I confess to a complete misunderstanding of the situation. Yet I now understand you to be a man of a singular knowledge and learning, and from our previous conversations, I suspect I also know the depth of your concern for humanity. You are a merciful man. Spare the sun, sir." "My lord," said the wizard, "if you have created, you have created this impasse. I ask a bit of time to consider your request and my response." Because, of course, the wizard is confused. The Yankee knows someone has the dates wrong, and he has also no control over ending the eclipse at a simple request from the king. So he's playing for time. The king says, "How long a time, friend? See there, the shadow grows darker as we speak." "Aye, sire, yes, it does. I must have time to consider. I have much to consider. At least a half an hour, perhaps a full hour." There is another low moan from the multitudes. The king grants him a short recess and has him unchained from the pyre. But the wizard is still not sure of what to do next. He paces back and forth
the competing wizard, the storytelling wizard, is cogitating what stories he can invent to bring the advantage back to himself. And finally, it occurs to the wizard that he is still in a position of power because he knows what will happen next, even if he is not quite sure how soon it will happen, and he negotiates. "I do not want much, my lord, and you understand my powers, my knowledge, my learning, what I could bring to this kingdom. Grant me simply 1% of whatever increase I can bring to the royal coffers and a place at your council permanently and for life, and I will reverse the process. But, my lord, because I am not sure yet I have your full confidence, I will allow the sky to darken. I will allow the sun to disappear. And when I am sure that you are a believer, I will bring back the sun." The king argues for a moment. "No, there is no need, sir. There is no need to obliterate the sun. Even if only for a moment, you have my word. You can have this place at council. You will have the increase from the coffers. There is no need for you." But the sun continues to disappear. And the Yankee simply points at the sun. And when finally the sun begins to come back, he points at the sun again and says, "I believe the king believes." The king bows his head before the wizard, and that's the crux of the story.
That's great.
You'll have to listen to more of Enlightened Radio to hear further adventures of this Yankee in King Arthur's court, who's not quite the same as Mark Twain's. Okay, I'm done, Stosh.
Thanks. That was great. You know, there are a couple of movies about that.
Yeah, the Connecticut Yankee. Yeah.
And in one of them, I remember, it's a young boy.
Clarence. Oh, really?
Yeah, he's a young boy, you know, and he's pretty young, like 12 or 13. So that's interesting.
Is that the cartoon version?
No.
I
think the first one I saw, I believe, was with Bing Crosby.
Yes, there is one with Bing Crosby.
Okay, so that's neat. And certainly Mark Twain's words are great.
Yes.
Doesn't sound like an ordinary storyteller when you use Twain's words.
Yes, that's true.
Sounds like someone's been educated, maybe in Connecticut. And I like the way you told that. I did. That's, you know, that's neat. The description of the post and the wood and him being chained to it.
It's scary.
It's one of the worst things I can imagine. And has often given me nightmares because of the Middle Ages. And
yeah, just reading the story was pretty scary.
That's pretty neat. Well, thanks for sharing that story. And you got that from the book?
Yeah. You go to any used bookstore that has a good collection of American literature, and you can find A Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court by Mark Twain. And it's not a very long story. You can read it in an hour or so.
Right. That's wonderful. So I think now you could give our listeners some details about Megan Hicks and stories in their own.
Okay. So Megan Hicks is a storyteller and an origami artist and creator of fairy tales, as well as many other different kinds of stories, personal stories, and a little social commentary thrown in there. She'll be joining us from Media, Pennsylvania, outside Philadelphia, on the 28th of this month at 7 p.m. It's Stories in the Round, and that the location for Stories in the Round every month is at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Hagerstown at 13245 Searfoss Pike. That's Salem Avenue extended west of town. And if you want more information about that, you can get your tickets in advance for $10 or pay at the door for 12, but in any case, you can reach me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638. You can also email me at fanitsky@hotmail.com, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com. And then I also wanted to tell our listeners that on September 25th, next month, we're going to be hosting Fred Powers, West Virginia storyteller, retired United Mine Workers of America coal miner, and middle school teacher. He's also an actor and a parent and a grandparent. He'll be making his debut at Stories in the Round to tell of his experiences growing up, living and working and raising a family in the mining communities of West Virginia. Fred and his grandchildren, by the way, participated in the filming of a History Channel film on the Matewan Massacre and the Battle of Blair Mountain and other episodes from U.S. mining history. So I've heard Fred tell before. I think you have too, Stosh. And but we're going to hear some additional tales, I think.
Sounds
also.
I'm looking forward to that. Two good people coming up.
Yeah.
And the other story series, Speak Story series, we've had some wonderful experiences there in Shepherdstown this year. And coming up September 19th is Bill Harley. Normally that series is on the second Tuesday of the month, but Bill's engagements made it necessary to move the series to the third Tuesday. So September 19th with Bill Harley. And in October, a special presentation by Jan Blake from England by Skype. She will be able to see the audience, we'll be able to see her, and it'll be interactive.
That's such an incredible feat of technology. I love that that's possible.
It's wonderful. November 14th, Mark Harshman, West Virginia Poet Laureate, and he has written a number of books. I believe it's 14 children's books, and he'll be there on November 14th. And then the series wraps up on December 12th with Adam Booth, the Speak Story series creator. For more information, you can go to speakstoryseries.com.
You're going to tell us a story, Stosh.
I am.
Is this the right time to do that, or did you want to...
No, I think it's fine.
...do other kinds of business first?
No. We don't have to do any banking or anything, so...
That's a relief.
Let's do a station ID. Okay. Listening to the enlightenedradio.org, and you're with co-host Stosh Zielkowski. That's
and
me.
Fanny Crawford.
And Fanny Crawford. And we just heard Fanny tell a version of the Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, and which has to do with an eclipse. And there's going to be a great eclipse this afternoon. Hopefully lots of people out looking at it safely. Do not look at the sun without protection. And be careful, even if you bought glasses. Sometimes those glasses are fakes, and people making a lot of money selling those. In fact, I talked to our librarian, and she said she had, for the last 3 weeks, she's not been able to get glasses she was ordering for the library, but they're going like hotcakes.
Yeah.
So,
You can use your cell phone.
You can use your cell phone, right.
Stand like you're taking a selfie with the phone behind you, with the sun behind you, and just watch your phone.
And I'm not sure how that works, really. I'm not sure in the bright sun if you'll be able to see the screen.
Oh. They did it on TV.
I know.
I guess that's not the test, though.
And one of the dragons died last night on TV.
Oh.
So,
from
Game of Thrones.
Okay. But not from looking at the sun, I trust.
No.
Okay.
Okay. So, I have a little anecdote and then a story. And I'd like to tell the anecdote first because it will...
inform the story?
Possibly inform my love for astronomy and teaching about astronomy. Years ago, I lived in Maryland in a place called Westminster and had a wonderful backyard, and there were no street lights. We were on a country road 10 miles from town. No street lights, no lights at all on the road. So you could go out at night, look up at the sky, and on a clear night you could see just this gorgeous display of stars, planets. And at the time I had a small telescope, but it was good enough to see some nice things in the sky. One particular night I was out looking, and I had always wanted to see the rings of Saturn. And even though you can see Saturn frequently throughout the year, you can only see it occasionally over a period of years when, because of the turning of the planet and the juxtaposition of our planet and the sun, the rings are often straight on at you, and so it just looks like a straight line. But sometimes the planet is tilted in relation to our sight, and you can see the rings clearly. Well, this evening was in 1975, and it was dark. My daughters were in bed, and I was outside with my telescope, and I got it set and could see Saturn's rings. They were tilted. And without hesitation, I ran to the house, went into my oldest daughter's bedroom, and shook her awake and said, "Come with Daddy." Took her outside in her nightgown and got her set up at the telescope and said, "You're going to be able to see the rings." And I adjusted the telescope. She could look through the eyepiece, and she said, "Oh, Daddy," which was one of my greatest memories of, of my daughter's childhood, because she was so impressed and so pleased that she could actually see that. So that's what happened in 1975. Now, as an educator and sometime a performer, storyteller, I am one of my personal heroes is Galileo Galilei, who lived in the 16th century. He was a contemporary with some famous people, Shakespeare, though they never met, Queen Elizabeth II, they never met, and lots of Italians. In the year 1609, Galileo, who had already been working on lots of scientific principles and doing a lot of great investigations, was made aware of an object that had been created by a man named Hans Lippershey, a Dutchman. And Hans Lippershey ground lenses for different things. And he had put together two lenses in a tube and created what he thought was an interesting toy, almost. Maybe just a little bit next step from a toy. Because you could point the instrument at distant things and they appeared closer. Galileo was able to get one of these, and he soon realized that what he had was an incredible scientific device. He could study the heavens with it. He was able to convince the leaders of the town that they should invest in this. He eventually had a man making them in his house, and he had this man, and he collaborated and made them better than the ones that Lippershey had made. The way Galileo convinced these men to invest was he took them up to a high point in one of the buildings where he could look out at the harbor. And he had checked with the harbor master people there and found out they were expecting some ships bringing goods in. Well, they had to wait a while, but they pointed this thing, which became known as the telescope, at the distant horizon, and in a matter of minutes, ships appeared where none could be seen before. And there were two things that were impressed on the men who became investors. One was that the earth was round, though everyone knew that at the time. But seeing the ships come up from the horizon, and they could watch as they got closer and closer, it turned out to be a great instrument for the shippers, because they could actually see about how long it would take for the ships to come into port, and they could organize the people to unload them and things like that. Well, Galileo turned his instruments to the sky. And one of the first discoveries he made, which caused quite a bit of problem for him, was that the moon had craters and mountains. In his sketchbooks, he made sketches of depressions on the moon and bumps. And he could see that they were, some were pretty high because there were shadows. And this upset quite a bit of people, especially quite a bit of church people, because at that time, Aristotle's vision of the universe was that the moon was perfect, and that all the planets were just so, and the moon had no defects. Being made by the Supreme Being, there could be no defects on the moon. Galileo also was able to zoom in on the planet Saturn. Unfortunately, his telescope was not very powerful, not even as powerful as the one I bought for about $60 in 1970. And he could see Saturn. And he, in his notebook, he wrote, "It's strange. Without my telescope, I can see Saturn. It seems like a point, a ball. But through the telescope, it looks like it has ears." Well, it turns out, as he got better and better scopes over the years, and then other astronomers followed him, they discovered that those ears were truly the rings around Saturn. And because his telescope couldn't resolve the picture very well, it looked like a bump on either side of the planet. Along with that, Galileo looked at Jupiter. Another discovery that upset some church fathers. He found that there were four stars no one had ever seen before near Jupiter. And over a period of time, he decided they really weren't stars, because the stars in the sky never moved. Only planets moved. And the sun and the moon. And what he discovered was those four stars sometimes disappeared. Sometimes one disappeared and he could only see three. Sometimes two disappeared, he could only see two. Sometimes three disappeared, he could only see one. And he realized, with his continual watching over many nights, that they were moving behind Jupiter and then reappearing in front. And so he deduced that Jupiter had four moons. And those moons are called the Galilean moons. And they are well studied now by astronomers. In his notes, he kept beautiful drawings of them. One other thing that he did that really stands out, just one of many things he accomplished in his career, was he discovered sunspots. There's a great deal of discussion in writings nowadays about him and his eyesight and sunspots. We are always warned, don't stare at the sun. It's dangerous. Uh-huh. And that's true. If you stare at the sun without any kind of protection for your eyes, you can definitely damage your eyes. Many people in the last, say, 20 years, 10 years, have been writing in scientific papers that Galileo did not damage his eyes by studying sunspots. he really had glaucoma or maybe cataracts and things like that. Well, I can't go back 400 years and guess exactly what happened, but he did do a great deal of work on sunspots. In fact, his drawings of sunspots were able to show astronomers that followed him the cycle of sunspots, which appears, they appear in an 11-year cycle. And that activity interferes with some of our modern things that happen on our planet because of the radiation given off by the sunspots. Some of his drawings actually show the sunspots over a period of time and how they move across the face of the sun. So all of his work, which inspired me as a young man when I first read about the telescope, an interesting thing about that is if you were to just walk down the street and ask 100 people who invented the telescope, probably 95 would say Galileo, but he didn't. He merely improved the instrument that he got off of a ship that came from Holland. And there are some of his telescopes still in Italy today in museums. But one of the things all of his work did to his life was cause him a great deal of turmoil and grief. In 1632, he was taken before a Inquisition in the Vatican, and he was charged with treason against the church, with heresy for teaching untruths, because he agreed with the Copernican theory that the sun is in one place and the earth moves around the sun. And so he was forced to refute his own work and read a statement that said it was only a theory and it was not true. There is a legend that says at the end of his statement, as he knelt at the front of the church before the Pope and a number of officials, that he finished his statement and muttered under his breath, "And yet it moves about the earth." So one other thing I'd like to mention about Galileo, about this story, is there's another great tale that people tell, that he took cannonballs up on top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropped them off to prove that it doesn't matter whether it's objects heavy or light, they fall at the same rate of speed. And that's not true. There's no place in his writings that says he did that. It's kind of like one of those legends. The truth is that he used some devices to measure the fall of the balls by rolling down a slope, and did it with a number of different weights, and was able to deduce that there is such a thing as gravity, which pulls things down at the same rate of speed, whatever their weight. Proof of this came in 1971, absolute proof of it, on the moon, when one of the astronauts held up a ball, a metal ball, and a feather. And in absence of an atmosphere on the moon, dropped them, and there's a film of it, and shows that they hit at the same time, even though one object was 100 times heavier than the feather. So, Galileo is a great guy in history, and it only took the Catholic Church, which he was a member of, 350 years to admit that they made a mistake and that Galileo was right. And they forgave him for being right.
You say that with a little too much glee.
It took him a long time.
It did. I remember seeing the Broadway play Galileo in Philadelphia, I think at the Theater in the Round, if I'm not mistaken, when I was in junior high school. And that it made a big impression on me, the misery that that man went through in his search for truth and in his unwillingness. So even after he recanted, he still insisted on writing and speaking and kept getting into trouble and died an unhappy man because of everything that was taken from him.
And he was in under house arrest for the last 8 years of his life. And for part of that time, he became totally blind.
Yeah.
And but at that time, he dictated his greatest work, a scientific book that was smuggled out of the country and published and became one of the best works ever on the kind of work that he did.
And his daughter remained loyal and lived with him for most of that time.
Right, and took care of him. Right. I didn't mention one other thing about Galileo, if I may.
Sure.
I worked at a private school in Baltimore where I was the planetarium director, did a lot with teaching the children about the stars and things. And at that school, they would grant teachers a summer grant to do certain kind of research or prepare something special that could be used in school. And so I was given $2,000 to develop a one-man show about Galileo. And I was able to perform that show as Galileo. At the time, I had hair not only on my face, but on my head, and perform this show and told about the Pisa, story.
The tower.
And has a joke that entertained the kids by saying that. That wouldn't be fun to do. My poor assistant would have to run from the bottom of 500 steps to tell me yes, they hit at the same time, stuff like that. But because of that grant, I was able to construct a piece of equipment, a 14-foot semicircle. I didn't actually build it. I had it done at a mill. And I had bowling balls, which I was able to get it. Bowling alleys are really good about giving away old bowling balls.
It is easier to get bowling balls than cannonballs.
It is.
These days.
In many different ways. And I had a nice ladder set up so that I could get kids out of the audience to come up and set the bowling ball on the ramp of this semicircle. And then we would time how long it took the ball to roll 10 times back and forth. And no matter what the weight of the ball was, the time was always exactly the same. So it was very nice, and I had a wonderful time doing it, and it was part of my pay. So it was great.
Oh, I wish I had been there. A kid in the audience. I would not have been a kid, but it would have been fun. What a great story, Stosh. Thank you. We have a little bit of business to take care of before we end. The show. You've talked about the Speak Story series and given the contact, which is speakstoryseries.com for Adam Booth's series. And I've given a little information about Stories in the Round and given my phone number, 301-730-1638 or fenitsky@hotmail.com. But I also wanted to talk about podcasts. Our listeners will be able to hear a podcast of this show if they go to talltales.enlightenradio.org. And, of course, many, many other podcasts are also up there from past programs. I've been to two reunions in the past month. Stosh, I went to my family reunion at the beginning of August, and this past weekend I went to my 50th high school reunion. I'm still,
I thought that was a mistake. I thought the number was a mistake.
No, it's not a mistake. And I told you this morning that you asked how I was, and I said I was a bit discombobulated. Well, the other half of my discombobulation was about going to my 50th. High school reunion. Maybe we'll have a show about reunions at some point. That was an experience. But what I wanted to say about both those reunions, my family reunion and the high school reunion, several people that I would not have expected necessarily to be interested came up to tell me that they had listened to podcasts of the show. So
we have
a following out there somewhere, as far away as Rochester, New York, and Olean, New York, and Jamestown, and Philadelphia, And there were people at their high school reunion from California and Florida as well. So if our listeners want to hear podcasts, they just go to talltales.enlightenradio.org. And you and I both will be telling stories on August 27th at Daubs Woods Park in Hagerstown with Renee Emanuel and Larry Hayes and Marion James, other storytellers who will be with us, 1 to 3 p.m. on August 27th at Art in the Park at Daubs Woods Park. And that's an event that's being pulled together by Ron Vital from Hagerstown. So a shout out to him and thanks for organizing all of that for us. And listeners can get more information about that event also by calling me, although that may be all you need is to show up at the band shell at, or the stage at Daubs Woods Park at 1 p.m. on Sunday the 27th. It's a good thing you're here to correct all my numbers, Stosh.
Not always.
That's so. I'm going to turn back to you, and you're going to take us out.
Are we ready to
close out? We've done most of our business. So on the podcast, we'll have you telling your Galileo story, and I will have a recording of me doing my own version. Let me say right. that. It's not Mark Twain's version. It's my own version right. of Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court. Anything else you want to add?
I'd just like to suggest, if you're interested in the sky and stars and everything that's going on as far as astronomy, two men to keep in mind. One who has passed away, Carl Sagan, who was devoted to the physics and astronomy, and his successor in New York at the Hayden Planetarium, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh, yeah.
Who is not only a brilliant researcher and theoretician about this astronomy, but also very engaging and funny. I got to see him in Pittsburgh last year, and he gave a wonderful performance for 2 hours. That was enlightening and also humorous. So look for those. And you've been listening to enlightenradio.org, community radio, independent community radio. And we're signing off at the end of our hour today. The Enlighten Radio Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand your stories. Thanks for listening. And
jazz coming up.
Jazz coming up following this program.
John's
giving me a thumbs up. Thank you very much.
Talk to you next week.